The Athletic.
I don't even know where to begin with Chelsea.
I think it's the perfect appointment for the squad they've got at their disposal. I think it's a great job for Sean Dyche to get.
I think the biggest surprise was not having a direct replacement to come in for him. I think we all expected that.
Their spend this window makes Roman look like quite a miserly figure in the boardroom.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. I'm Dan Bardell and this is the Weekend Preview. Coming up, we're going to look ahead to Sean Dyche beginning his reign at Everton as Arsenal head to Goodison Park. Newcastle take on West Ham and Manchester City begin life without João Cancelo away to Tottenham, who are themselves without Antonio Conte. That's all to come here on the Weekend Preview. But before we get into the action, the January transfer window slams shut this week. I'm going to ask you each who you think were the winners and who you think were the losers from January. Rich, I'm going to come to you first. Your winner and your loser, please.
My winner, I'm going to go with Arsenal, getting in the likes of Trossard and Jorginho, you know, two proven Premier League players. Players who've excelled at this level. Trossard gives them flexibility and versatility. He can play out wide, he can play wing back as well, can also play through the middle. And you know, we all know Jorginho's quality on the ball, especially, you know, when Arsenal are trying to see out games as well. And the losers, well, it's not looking good up at Merseyside, is it? Liverpool didn't really strengthen, but I mean, of course, Everton, you have to look at them because, you know, okay, they got a new manager in, but no new signings, looking very, very, very bleak up there. And, you know, really missed a big opportunity to freshen things up. So, things are not looking great for them at all. So my winners are Arsenal and my losers are Everton.
Hard to disagree with either of those answers, to be honest. Did see on The Athletic this morning that Andre Ayew may well end up in Merseyside at Everton. Steve, do you disagree with Rich?
No, like him, I had those two written down. But I just think, I mentioned Brighton for keeping Caicedo and having all their staff picked, whether it be on the pitch or off the pitch. They bought in, what, three teenagers. They're bound to be worth £100 million in about 2 years' time. So it's just them, just for being a really well-run club. And I'm just interested to see how those new signings just progress, whether they go out on loan and or hit the Premier League. It's just a very good football club, isn't it?
Yeah, sad to say we'll be talking about those players this time next year, I suspect. George, finally, I'll come to you. Are you deviating from the other two?
No, my winners of the summer window, Everton, I think, have to be the losers of this window. But I still do think that under a now very capable manager, we'll probably look back on Everton's summer business as being better.
No, George, let it go, George.
No chance.
You've got to let that go.
It's a mid-table squad. I'm telling you, you'll see what Dyche does with it. We'll talk about it later. In terms of winners, I mean, I do think there's a fair chance that at least one and maybe both of these teams will be playing in the Championship next season. And I'm not going to pretend to know a great deal, but people who know their onions about European football seem to think that the business Southampton have done and the business of Bournemouth has been pretty good in terms of signing very promising young players. Sulemana coming in from Rennes at Southampton is seemingly a really good prospect. And then with Bournemouth as well, you know, who look like they need an injection of some quality at this stage. The centre-back from Kiev, Zabarini, Antoine Semenyo, a player I know very well from Bristol City, is a really exciting prospect too. So it may not be enough to save them, but in terms of long-term planning, it feels like two clubs who, rather than doing what we see a lot of teams who are threatened about going out of the Premier League do and spend big money on older players in a desperate attempt to stay up, they're doing it right and getting in young players who, if they do go down, will be top talents to try and get them back up into the top flight next season.
Yeah, I spoke to a member of the Bournemouth coaching staff on deadline day and he was very excited about the centre-back, the Ukrainian centre-back, who I'm not even going to try and pronounce his name.
Well, because I butchered it.
No, I thought you did all right. To be honest, I've no idea whether it's wrong or right, to be perfectly honest, but they're very, very excited about him. He sounds like he's some prospect and has got a lot of experience, especially in Europe already. So it'll be interesting to see how Bournemouth and Southampton's new boys get on. The transfer window shut, as I just mentioned. It's only right we start with Chelsea against Fulham, which is Friday at 8 o'clock. George, I don't even know where to begin with Chelsea. We could do a whole podcast just talking about deadline day. We could do about 10 podcasts talking about them in the January transfer window in general. It's absolutely crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we're seeing so many viral tweets going around saying how Chelsea spent more in this window than teams in La Liga, Serie A, Liga, and the Bundesliga combined, and the rest of it. You know, they've broken all kinds of records, doubled the total spend in one window from any team as well. And when we were talking about who was the winner and the loser of the window, I was kind of half tempted to bring up Chelsea in terms of being the winners, but you just can't really because of the amount of that they've spent, because you've got to look at this as being value for money. I personally think that when you've got a club like Chelsea with a huge wealth, who are quite clearly gaming the system in terms of the amortization of value of players by offering these long-term contracts, if they can afford it, then fair play to them. I think if Enzo Fernandez goes on and wins 2 Ballon d'Ors in his career, no one's going to look back at the eye-watering fee they paid for someone who's only played half a season of football in Europe. And then the other players they brought in, they're all of really good ages. They're all players who are up and coming and would be seen as being a great acquisition for basically any elite club in world football. It's just the price tag that has people getting a bit concerned. So, yeah, I mean, I never see anything like this. I think Todd Bowley's certainly shown his hand now to be someone who's willing to invest in the football side of things. And the end of the Roman Abramovich era, their spend this window makes Roman look like quite a miserly figure in the boardroom.
Yeah, someone who's not used to spending money, Steve Freith. I don't know what to make of it. I change my mind daily on what I think of this Chelsea transfer window. Some days I think this is actually going to turn out to be really clever, obviously, that the contract situations that they've got going on with the players as well. Other days I think this is absolute madness, what they're doing to football. Is it somewhere in the middle? What do you make of it?
I don't mind spending money, Dan, as long as it's on expenses. I've bought you a drink in the past. Chelsea, yeah, true, what do you think? I'm like you. I chop and change my mind, and I just look at it as from a betting point of view. I see a side that are 8-1 to finish in the top four, which is a huge price. Let's not forget the start of the season; they were almost that price to win the Premier League, not just to finish in the top four. They were shorter than 10-1 on to finish in the top four. It ain't going to happen. You know, all this money that they've spent, really. You know, the odds suggest that it's not going to happen, or it's going to take a bit of a shot for it too. And you see all these players coming from a Premier League brand point of view, it's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? I think we're all excited to see how they do. Enzo Fernandez was 33-1 young player of the year. Young player of the World Cup. Quite a few people backed that before the tournament started, and he went on to have a decent tournament. I think we're excited about Mudryk as well. Just a penny for the thoughts of Graham Potter, really. I think he might need to be more Harry Potter to try and get to work his magic to get them in the top four. And I don't envy him one little bit, Dan, on picking the side, particularly against Fulham on Friday night.
No, I mean, no João Félix, of course, because he was sent off in the return fixture of this game. Can it be a return fixture when it's
reverse
first?
Isn't it?
I don't know. Reverse fixture, that's what I'm looking for. Félix obviously got sent off against Fulham, so he's still missing now to play Fulham again, which is also very strange. Everything that involves Chelsea at the moment is strange, Rich. Doesn't affect them for this game, but the squad is obviously so big now. I can only actually register 3 players for the knockout phase of the Champions League, or 3 new players, I should say. So there's going to be some of these big players that have come in. They're not going to be allowed to play in the Champions League.
It'd be interesting to see who he picks. I mean, he's got such a big number to pick from. There will be some unhappy names. But, you know, at the same time, these young players are coming, and they know they're coming into a competitive squad. So, you know, to say Potter have a big ask to keep them happy. But on at the same time, the players know they're coming into a very, very competitive environment, and they need to show their quality in order to get selected, whether it's for Champions League squad or in the Premier League. And even before this January splurge, you know, no team had used more players in the Premier League this season than Chelsea. There's 29 so far. And they're really struggling to settle on a starting 11 as well. I think, you know, they've made 73 changes to their starting 11s this season, which is by far more than any other side. I think almost 20 more changes. So we're seeing an issue with consistency. We're seeing an issue with, you know, getting that consistent lineup. And I think once they're able to do that, we'll see much improved performances. You know, players can start building relationships with each other on the field, and little partnerships here and there. But yeah, it'd be a tough job to get that to happen.
Yeah, not to be outdone, Fulham have done their own weird thing at the end of January. Shane Duffy's move to Fulham is made permanent, despite only playing 4 Premier League minutes so far this season. But what this has done, George, is it's enabled Cedric Suarez to join on loan from Arsenal, a player who likes to cross the ball into the box. He's got the perfect foil there in Mitrovic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a a shrewd signing, you have to say. I mean, the Duffy signing is one of the weirdest ones I think we've seen in any window, where an unsuccessful loan in terms of the fact he's barely featured. I wonder if he needed any persuading, because, yeah, he had to. They had to make one of their loans permanent in order to get Suarez in. But, you know, Marco Silva deserves massive credit for just simplifying how to manage Fulham. You look at Fulham when they came up under Scott Parker, and the way that Parker chopped and changed and ended up dropping Mitrovic only after a couple of weeks of the season. For Marco Silva, it is just get as many players on the pitch who can get a ball in to Mitrovic, and just get players playing in midfield who can break up play, recycle the ball, get it wide again, and rinse and repeat. And they're very good at doing it. And then Willian, you know, a really clever addition, somebody who can do that on the left-hand side, but also offers his own goal threat, also really tidy in possession. And Suarez is just another string to that bow, somebody who will get on the ball, he'll look to cross from deep, he'll look to overlap and get to the byline and cross from there as well. And, you know, football, sometimes we can overcomplicate things. And when you've got a player like Mitrovic, who you know is A, very aggressive in the air, wins most of his headers, and is an elite finisher with his head, just do whatever you can to get the ball in his head as much as possible. And that's what Silva's doing, and that's what I'm sure Suarez will do as well.
We saw in the first game that, you know, Fulham did get joy of crosses, and, you know, in Fulham and Chelsea, you've got a team who are the best crossers of the ball in Fulham against a team who are the worst at defending crosses in Chelsea. Chelsea have conceded the biggest share, apart from Southampton, from crosses this season. Fulham have scored the most from crosses this season with 11. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that happens again, as we saw in the previous fixture, how Fulham got joy of crosses. And, likely we'll see that again, as George said really well.
Yeah, and they won a few weeks ago via a cross, and Mitrovic wasn't even there. So, yeah, that's a valid point to look at the crossing stats. Stay Fulham are currently in the dizzy heights of seventh, but are still 40-1 to finish in the top six.
Yeah, I think they're overachieving, Dan. I think if you look at their XG against, it's probably the highest in the Premier League. They've conceded 30, and the XG probably says 40. I think Mitro's been very hot this season. His non-penalty XG is very hot as well. He must have missed about 25 penalties in the last 3 weeks. He's had one shot on target actually this year. So maybe the signs of Mitro cooling down just a little bit. Maybe Leno's had a really good season.
Yeah,
his goals prevented. He's one of the best in the Premier League. You know, he's not at Alisson or Kepa standards, but he's not far below. So I'm just wondering just a little bit. I mean, let's be honest, their business at the start of the season, looking back at it now, you're thinking, wow, they've done some really good business there. And let's not forget that Fulham are one of the relegation favourites at the start of the season to go down. They've done extremely well, and it feels a little bit disrespectful to have them at 40-1 to finish in the top six. But as far as we're concerned, they're overachieving. Yeah, OK, they're playing well. I can just see them cooling just a little bit and maybe finishing mid-table. And let's be honest, Fulham fans would have taken that at the start of the season, and so would Silva.
Yeah, brilliant manager, brilliant recruitment as well, and Shane Duffy. So, yeah, well done, Fulham. Next, we'll look ahead to the start of another new era, Everton, as Sean Dyche takes the managerial hot seat. They take on league leaders Arsenal at Goodison Park.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Weekend Preview here on the Athletic Football Podcast. Myself, Dan Bardell, joined by George Ellick, Richard Mofa, and Steve Freeth. Everton v Arsenal is Saturday lunchtime, 12:30 kickoff, and George, Sean Dyche is in. They were looking at Bielsa for a bit. It's ended up being Sean Dyche. Obviously, two managers that are exactly the same. Is that a good appointment?
I think it's a great appointment. I think it's the perfect appointment for the squad they've got at their disposal. I think it's a great job for Sean Dyche to get. I think for him to take over a club who not so long ago were able to hire elite managers, Dan, such as Carlo Ancelotti, in their quest to go and qualify for Europe. You know, for Dyche to take on a club at their lowest ebb, but clearly have the financial clout in the transfer market, as we saw in the summer, to go out and spend fairly big, who have aspirations to get themselves back into being a top six, top eight club. You know, the potential for what he can do with them dwarfs what he was able to do with the Burnley side. That we have to remember, he ended up once getting into seventh position at the end of a Premier League season. So it's a great job for Dyche. I think there's a lot of snobbery around him and his management methods. I anticipate that he will you know, it will still probably be fairly pragmatic and fairly agricultural, but with a better quality of technical player at his disposal, possibly more effective. It's easy to forget as well that plenty of really decent strikers have scored a lot of goals under Dyche in the past as well, looking at Danny Ings, Sam Vokes, Ashley Barnes, Jay Rodriguez. You know, he gets a tune out of strikers. So for, you know, we talk about simplifying the method of route to goal for Fulham. If Dominic Calvert-Lewin can stay fit, I have a feeling Sean Dyche will be probably the best thing that's happened in Calvert-Lewin's career in terms of turning him into a really effective striker. There clearly are issues in terms of the strategy. Like if you are recruiting for a job and the last two people that you're interviewing are Sean Dyche and Marcelo Bielsa, then something is clearly wrong, especially when one of those last two candidates suggests that he should coach the academy till the end of the season. In my mind, that's probably not the worst idea from Bielsa in terms of long-term potential for a club, but it shouldn't get that far that one of your key candidates actually has no interest in taking over the job in order to do the most pressing job at hand, and that's to keep Everton up. Not to mention the clear differences in culture that each would want to create, the different strategies, different formations, the different philosophies, a madness. So it does feel to me like maybe Everton have stumbled into the perfect candidate for the job, but I personally am much more positive about the alignment for what Everton are at this moment in time and the appointment of Sean Dyche compared to the appointment of Lampard, compared to the appointment of Ancelotti. You know, it just feels like this is much more of... Danny, you scoff, but the signings that they made under Ancelotti at a time where they were in a position to really go and push forward, you look at the recruitment of Allen, you look at the recruitment of James. It was all just an incredibly short-term, high-spend turnaround, which was never going to lead to sustainable success. Like, at least with Dyche, you've got someone in the door now who, if things go well, there's no reason why he can't be a manager for the next 6, 7, 8 years and operate a proper project that can be sustainable and they can have a clear identity throughout who they are. That was never going to be the case under Everton's previous managers, except for maybe Lampard, but there wasn't very much to suggest that he was up to the task of doing the job. So... I'm really excited. I'm excited to see him back in the Premier League. And I think there's an opportunity as well where Everton are pretty much going to be the only side in the league who look to play the way they're going to look to play. And I think that can be a big benefit as well, where it doesn't matter that you might not have the technical advantage of your opposition. If you can execute your game plan better against a side who are going to look to have the ball and play a high line, then that gives you an advantage in plenty of games.
And in fairness, that's when they were last good.
Yeah.
Under David Moyes, when they had that identity. It was different to everyone else, but it worked and they were successful. Some part of me though, Rich, I like Sean Dyche. I'll caveat this by saying I really like Sean Dyche and I do think it's a good appointment. But in some ways, I don't think it matters who the manager is, because we've seen with teams previously, if you're not managed above very well, we've seen Sunderland go down, Villa go down, Leeds go down. It almost doesn't matter who the manager is, because you can circle the drain for so long and eventually you'll fall down. And to me, it still feels like even though Dyche is in, that's what's going to happen to Everton.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. When the culture around the club is as negative as what it is, it takes a lot for it to be dragged out. And, you know, for Dyche, you know, he has to hit the ground running. There's no doubt about it. As you say, if he's able to raise the spirits around the club, then as you say, you may be able to see an improvement. But, you know, you talk about the higher ups and stuff, and we know the mess that has been there has been very well documented. We spoke about it on previous podcasts. And as you say, not bringing anyone in, not necessarily to just replace Anthony Gordon. Obviously, he's a big miss. He's not really been playing that well this season. But to just not really bring in reinforcements and try and freshen things up on the pitch as well as obviously in the dugout is a big mistake. And as you say, I'm sure some names will come out in over the next couple of days of who they've targeted and who they've missed. Is that kind of decision-making... As you say, you can have the best manager in the world, but if you're not getting that support, what can you do? You know, as George said, I think Everton will have to go back to basics, just really be, you know, pragmatic, you know, men behind the ball, try and play the counter-attack and try and get a tune out of Dominic Calvert-Lewin. And if they're able to do that, especially early doors, then we may be able to see an upturn. But things are just looking so bleak at the moment. It's difficult to see where the next win's going to come from and the positive performance
It's been a disastrous January for Everton as well. They've lost Anthony Gordon, who we're going to discuss later on in the show. Steve, what's this done for Everton in terms of the markets?
Yeah, ordinarily, I think, Dan, I'd have been pushing Everton out for relegation if Sean Dyche would have appointed. I, like the rest of the panel, think he's a good appointment and the right appointment. But it's just the fact that their rivals have strengthened so much, whereas Everton have lost the player, not a key one, but
as in he hasn't played a great deal this season, got more cards than bookings. He's got more cards than goals, I beg your pardon, this season. But we actually cut them from 8 to 13 to 8 to 15 to be relegated. So that's just goes to show the sort of job that, you know, Sean Dyche really has on his hands, and it's going to take a lot, you would have think, for to get that sort of Burnley side that stayed up for five seasons so consistently. That Burnley side just gave up so many shots, yet there were shots of such low quality that it didn't really matter that he got them into Europe. You know, just incredible, really. I think it's a good appointment. I think it's the right appointment. But from an odds point of view, we think they're going to be in the Championship next season.
Yeah, and there's a market for combined points from Sean Dyche's first two games, isn't there, Arsenal and Liverpool, Steve?
Yeah, Arsenal at home and Liverpool away, of course. Two really tough games. So I want the panel's opinion on how many points you think they'll get combined over those two games. Georgie?
One.
Okay, 9-4. Okay.
Yeah, I think one as well.
One against Liverpool. I suppose you don't mind Liverpool. Playing Liverpool at the moment.
No, exactly.
Dan?
0-0.
Yeah, 0 points is odds on, as you'd expect, 10 to 11. So, yeah, it's not looking good. It might get a little bit worse, but it gets better at Goodison Park.
I do think the game against Arsenal will be tight, though. I think there'll only be one goal in it. It feels like that's the I think it'll get them organised, won't it? It'll be a plucky performance, but Arsenal will be too good for them in the end, and their quality will show through. We've already discussed Arsenal's January at the top end of the show, but Jorginho is probably the most intriguing one. Doesn't really fit in with their transfer policy that they've had. I suppose Trossard doesn't either, but I was reading a piece from Art de Rocher this morning talking about why they've done it, and it is justifiable, and they've pulled in two players in particular there with big Premier League experience that could be pivotal players in the running.
Yeah, it is interesting to see Arsenal have had such a clear identity in the transfer market, going out and signing two players who are a bit older. The Trossard deal especially, you know, paying a fair amount of money for a guy who's in his late 20s isn't necessarily how I'd normally expect them to operate, but he's looked really lively early on. They knew they needed a body in there, and he brings that quality. He's match fit, having played loads. The Jorginho one's really interesting, where I can't really see why he would play that much from here till the end of the season. You know, I think in an ideal world, they will stick with having Thomas Partey as being the man who sits in front of the back four. And there's nowhere really that, you know, Jorginho isn't going to play on that left-sided role that we see Xhaka take up, where he's kind of playing in that half space and then can drop in next to Partey if they do switch to a two, with Odegaard moving into the 10 role, Odegaard playing off the right and then often playing as a 10. He obviously can't play there either. So in an ideal world, it feels to me like Jorginho's main minutes are going to come in Europe, in the Europa League. But just bringing in a guy who has the experience that Jorginho has got into that dressing room now, you know, somebody who won the Euros not that long ago, who has been part of, you know, who won the Champions League with Chelsea not particularly long ago, basically just a winner. A winner into a squad who have players who have certainly haven't won a Premier League anytime soon, haven't won a great deal between them, an incredibly young front line. A guy who's one of the best penalty takers in the world, which you have no idea what kind of impact that can make as well, is really smart recruitment. You know, he's clearly got that experience, will come in and have a bit of an aura around him in the dressing room. So even if he doesn't play a great deal this season, and we know that Thomas Partey's had his own injury issues at times in the last couple of years, he's a brilliant backup to have, especially when you consider, you know, the players who were there previously. Like if you look at Arsenal's Europa League side before Jorginho came in, it was Elneny and Lokonga. I mean, he is a massive, massive upgrade on that. So it's a really smart signing. Regardless of how much he plays, he improves things in terms of depth, and he also brings that winning mentality to the squad as well.
I just think it's a better signing than overpaying for Kaiser. Yeah, yeah. In all honesty, for what he'll bring in terms of experience and leadership as well, I think it ticks more boxes than the Caicedo transfer, but maybe we'll see Arsenal go back in for him in the summer and they'll add him to the ranks as well. That's Everton against Arsenal. Next, it's Newcastle United against West Ham United. Saturday tea time kickoff there. Steve, Newcastle make their first final since 1999 with a 3-1 aggregate win over Southampton in the week. What's the price on them lifting the Carabao Cup?
It's been a while, haven't they, since they've won Silverware Fairs Cup in 69, the Anglo-Italian Cup in 73, the Texaco Cup in 74 and 75. They also won it, Dan.
I've never even heard of the Texaco Cup. I don't even know what that is.
Albion got to a final once, I'm pretty sure, in the early 70s.
Mediocre, then.
Yeah, you'll have to. Well, it's definitely no European Cup.
No.
So they are favourites, but only slightly at even money with Manchester United at 4-5. Before that trip to Tranmere, way back then at the start of the competition. They were 14-1 to do that. So 14-1 into evens, all looking very good for Eddie Howe and co.
Yeah, Rich Bruno, though, is missing for this one. A real lightning rod for them, really, in the midfield, a real game changer. Someone who, since he's come in, has just lit up their midfield. Being without him, that is a big miss.
It is, because he's so key and integral to the way they play. You know, he's the one who starts the attacks, he gets the ball moving. You know, just love watching him, his balance, his poise, his passing range, his shooting, everything about him is just a fantastic midfielder. I love the way he links up very well with Almiron as well, when Almiron cuts in and then it will give him goes, and he's proven to be quite profitable this season. But I think against West Ham, you'd like to think Newcastle will have enough quality to get over the line. Longstaff is in decent form. Matty Willock too. Yep. So I think they'll be fine. I think, you know, maybe if they're playing against, you know, a top six rival, which what you can call them now, you might worry. But I think against the West Ham side, who are in, you know, showing slight upturns, but not in great form, you still expect Newcastle to get the job done without him.
I was going to say, I assume it's going to be Joel Linton moving back into the three, won't it? And then Sam Maximan starting up front. Well, in on the left-hand side of the three. And Sam Maximan's struggled to force his way into the side since coming out back in November, and we know that when he's on form, he's not a bad option to have. So it'll be interesting to see if he can take his chance to force his way back in.
You say it could be St. Maximin, George, but it also could be Anthony Gordon in for 40 million to much derision. What do you think?
Yeah, there's been, especially within the I guess analytics community, there's been a lot of scoffing about the signing of Gordon, and you know, you can see why clearly in terms of actual output, he hasn't done enough to justify that price tag. But I think it's pretty early to write him off, and when you're a player who's clearly got the raw attributes to be a pretty special player that Gordon has got, you know, he's very, very tenacious off the ball. I know that a lot of opposition fans don't particularly like how easily he goes down. And he's definitely got something on it. I think in terms of a work in progress and a bit of a blank canvas, it's. I'm not going to write him off right now. He's been playing in an incredibly poor Everton side for the last couple of years. So yeah, one of those players who seems to pass the eye test, but not necessarily the underlying numbers test. And I'm somebody who places probably more value in the data rather than the numbers, rather than the eye test. But at this stage, in the infancy of his career, moving to a club who are going to be unquestionably winning more games than they lose over the next couple of seasons, where he won't be the kind of the player that you have to stop as he was at Everton, and he should be given time to develop under a manager in Eddie Howe who has made much poorer players than Gordon look very, very good at Premier League level. I think this is one where we just have to wait and see, and he could flourish under him.
Yeah, West Ham fans, Steve, livid that Danny Ings and Brazilian centre-back Luizão were the only two additions. Is the lack of quality in the squad an issue? Because let's remember, they spent an awful lot of money in the summer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bundles of it. Younger players, I think, came in, didn't they? But it's an old squad, let's be honest. It must be the oldest squad in the Premier League, Dan. And they had that big win against Everton as well, you know, just a few weeks ago after that defeat against Wolves. And look at the games that are coming up after the Newcastle game. You've got Chelsea at home and Spurs away. Both of those sides, London, they'll be massively up for those games as well. But I think if David Moyes is listening to this, and I know that he does, he'll be pleased to know that they are 6-1 to be relegated. So they're about seventh on the list of our relegation sides that we think will be in trouble. And some people may think that's value. I know they've bought in Ings, Dan, as you know very well, but of course he's not fully fit at the moment. And Declan Rice's future, will he be going in the summer as well? You know, the goalies, old Fabianski's very old, Soufelle's 30. Ogbonna's 34, Antonio's 32. I'm just going through it now, and there are some old players in there. I know David Moyes has overachieved at West Ham for, obviously last season, but got to a Europa League semi-final, didn't he? But it doesn't feel a great season. Doesn't feel a happy place at the moment, West Ham, to me.
No, I mean, we talked about Moyes at Everton and what they did under his stewardship. In the summer, West Ham bought in players that really, to me, aren't David Moyes players at all, and that kind of has taken them away from what made them good in the previous two seasons. So you're right, West Ham not a happy place at the moment. The Danny Ings signing's a strange one. I don't think he fits in there at all. As good a player as he is and as good a goal scorer as he is, they don't play with two up front, so I just don't see how Danny Ings is going to make that much of a difference. This game is, of course, the Kevin Nolan derby. He's West Ham's first team coach now. Now, he played for both Newcastle and West Ham. The trivia question today is, who did he score more goals for? Steve, I'll come to you first.
Can I sing I'm in the mood for scoring? I think the Nolans sang that in the 70s. You won't have a clue what I'm on about. Most people
I've heard of the Nolans.
What I'm on about, but I just wanted to go, I'm in the mood.
Was, I know that.
Yeah,
everyone's heard that song. When I say everyone's heard that song, no one's ever heard it sung like that.
I'll go for Newcastle.
Newcastle, George?
Yeah, I reckon Newcastle as well.
Newcastle. Rich?
I always seem to remember Kevin Owen wheeling away doing his little chicken celebration at Newcastle. So that's what's in my head. But I'm going to be contrarian. I'm going to go for West Ham.
Oh, you've done the right thing, Rich, because he scored one more goal for West Ham than he did for Newcastle. It's 31 for West Ham.
Wow.
And 30 times he did that chicken celebration for Newcastle. So well done, Rich. You took the risk. Yeah. You moved away from the crowd. You changed your answer and you have won the quiz this week. Next, we're going to get on to Manchester City as they visit Spurs here on the Weekend Preview. This is the Weekend Preview here on the Athletic Football Podcast. Tottenham against Manchester City is Sunday at 4:30. And one of the stranger signings in recent times, or stranger moves in recent times, Rich, João Cancelo to Bayern. I mean, I was on Sky at the time when that got announced, and my terrible poker face probably summed up what everyone's thoughts of it were. We've heard all the stories since about the falling outs and whatnot, but it's still just, this is something that was unthinkable. Even a week ago, let alone 6 months ago, a year ago, you would never have expected this to happen.
No, not at all. I mean, we all know of João Cancelo's quality, both at right back and at left back. But, you know, as a really interesting report by Sam Lee and Paul Balus from The Athletic at the moment, just kind of talking about that fallout. And we know how Pep likes to have that kind of harmonious squad. I think he has a no bad faces policy. Whereas, you know, if you're not playing, you still want to show the right attitude. Look at Lasaraki, for example, who have shown that. And Cancelo was just the opposite. And it wasn't just a big fallout. It was more like a series of little things, like being on a bench against Arsenal, being subbed at halftime against Chelsea. And he's very vocal in showing his displeasure if he's not playing or if he gets subbed. And I think, you know, as I say, it wasn't one particularly big incident. It was just a series of little things where, you know, Pep Guardiola maybe started to see having an impact in the dressing room and thought, you know, we've got to get this player out. I think the bigger surprise was not having a direct replacement to come in for him. I think we all expected that. And he'll be a big miss for the quality that he's shown. But I mean, on the flip side, this season in the World Cup, he's not really been playing that well. You know, defensive lapses, you know, Liverpool game comes into mind. And they say if someone's having a negative impact in the dressing room, better to get them out than keep them in to stink out the place.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, isn't it, George? You know, Cancelo not being replaced, because we talk about all these players that they're saying have done well, but none of them play left back. Ake's done a very good job at left back. They've got Gomez there as well, who's not really done anything of note since he joined the club. I do think one positive thing potentially for Manchester City, I do think since Cancelo's come out the team, Jack Grealish has come alive a little bit, because I think Cancelo kind of got himself into the areas where Jack's so effective. So there is that. But like Rich says, there isn't really a natural left back. I suppose Cancelo wasn't a natural left back, but there isn't a real natural left back to play there now.
Yeah, we've got to remember that City won the league with Fabian Delph playing left back a couple of years ago. You know,
he's not there now, George. Can't call it funny.
You know, with Pep's system, you feel like it's when one quality player comes out, as you say, another one comes alive. I've been quite surprised how much, not outrage, but surprise there was that Cancelo has moved on. You know, as a player, when he's on form, I think he's one of the best players to watch in terms of creation from deep. You know, he got an assist on debut for Bayern on Wednesday evening, but he's been probably the most out of form elite player in European football since the beginning of the season. He was atrocious at the World Cup and lost his place for Portugal. I think it's a goal and two assists. Both assists came in the same game this season. He's looked a complete shadow of his former self, of the player that we know. And with Guardiola, we know there isn't much room for manoeuvre. We've seen players who are now key players for City, Bernardo Silva, Ilkay Gundogan, go very close to leaving the club after small patches of poor form. And with Cancelo, quite clearly there was a breakdown in relations between him and Pep as he came out of the side, and that was that. He was moved on. I don't think his absence this season will affect City at all. I think maybe part of the reason why City have struggled at times this season has been because of the lack of influence from Cancelo, who's been such an important player for the last two seasons. But he's offered nothing. So, yes, if he does well at Bayern, there will be some revisionism over him moving on. But he's been a shadow of what we've seen previously.
Before we talk about the hosts, there's a familiar voice here to tell us about Spurs this week. Let's hear from the Athletic Spurs reporter, Tim Spears.
Hi, guys, and hello, listeners. Hope you're all well. Sorry I can't be with you this week. It was a very busy sort of last 24, 48 hours for Spurs in the transfer window. High on their priority list was signing a right-wing back, and a right-wing back in the name of Pedro Porro, someone they'd been locked in negotiations for with Sporting for several weeks, with Sporting seemingly moving the goalposts on a number of occasions in terms of how the deal was structured. It was always going to be around €45 million, but it was just when those payments came, and Sporting, of course, wanted to sign a replacement as well. Eventually it got done, and yeah, a really key arrival for Spurs, who've been looking for a top level right wing back. Wing back's so important in Antonio Conte's formation, of course. So yeah, he's in. Matt Doherty's out. That was a real surprise, certainly in terms of his destination, which is Atletico Madrid. Initially, he was going to go there on loan. Then Spurs realised they'd cocked up the loan rules. So he eventually has gone on a free transfer. His contract's been terminated by mutual consent. And he goes to Atletico Madrid for the rest of the season, joining his Spurs teammate Sergio Reguilón, who's there on loan, and following in the footsteps, of course, of Kieran Trippier, who made that same move a few years ago. And Doherty sought Trippier's advice on the move. So, yeah, that's very interesting. Also interesting was Jed Spence going to Rennes on loan. We always knew that he would head out. But yeah, he joins Joe Rodon, who's also at Rennes on loan from Spurs, for the rest of the season. And Brian Hill went to Sevilla on loan, which was totally not a surprise. So yeah, interesting couple of days for Spurs. And then that continued on Wednesday morning when we found out that Antonio Conte was going to have an operation to remove his gallbladder, which happened yesterday. He's posted on Instagram to say that surgery went well. And I think it's unlikely we'll see him in the dugout, certainly for the big game against Man City on Sunday, in which case Christian Stellini, his assistant, who stood in for Spurs' fantastic win away at Marseille in the Champions League when Conte was suspended a few months ago, he'll step in. And of course, we all wish Conte a very quick and speedy recovery.
Very polite from Tim at the start of that voice. No, very no bad faces on this podcast. Got through a lot there in a short space of time of what's been going on at Spurs as well. George, the Antonio Conte thing, kind of, I feel like because of the transfer window being the way it was, it's kind of flown a little bit under the radar.
Yeah, it has. I mean, it's always hard to know how serious these things are. It's great news that for Antonio Conte that the surgery's obviously been okay. It can, from a footballing point of view, football obviously comes second or third or fourth or whatever when it's somebody's health in question. It's clearly not ideal for Tottenham to not have their manager with them at this stage, but hopefully he's back on the touchline fairly soon, and obviously we all wish him a speedy recovery.
Yeah, and the way of the Premier League at the moment, Spurs obviously played Manchester City not that long ago, Steve. Is there any lessons learned from that 4-2 reverse?
Yeah, don't go 2-0 up against them. I mean, it's not a dangerous scoreline, let's be honest. But with Manchester City, it seems to be. We saw Crystal Palace earlier in the season. Your boys, I think, end of last season, was it? Or recently when you threw away a lead there. And of course, we pay out when a team goes 2-0 up as well. So we paid out on both teams in this game. I seem to remember the game where Spurs caught them cold, didn't they, at the end of the first half. And it was bang, bang. And they were 2-0 up. And that's where the Manchester City fans... Bit of jeering, wasn't there? A bit of booing, yeah, as they booing. Walked off, they trudged off. And then obviously Pep had his say about the crowd afterwards as well. And it kind of, yeah, obviously Pep had, yeah, he did have a lot to say about that. But I think the story is just don't go 2-0 up against Manchester City.
Yeah, and Pedro Porro has joined Arnaut Danjuma to complete Spurs' January transfer window. Rich, have they finally replaced Kieran Trippier with Porro? I can't. They must have had so many wing backs in between the two of these now. I won't name them all, but there must have been a few. But yeah, that's probably fair that Kieran Trippier has probably never been efficiently replaced.
No, it hasn't. And you know, even looking at this season, you know, Doherty's not worked out. Emerson Royale's not worked out. Jed Spence not worked out, even though we know his potential. And it's a really, really big signing, really integral signing for Spurs, because you know, right wing back is so key to Antonio Conte's system, the way he likes to play. And if the aforementioned players not working out, you see a lot of attacks breaking down just when they get the ball out wide, whether to get a crossing or the end product has just not been good enough. Trippier will be hard to replace because, okay, he was maybe unspectacular at times, but he was someone who was always going to give you 7 out of 10 performance. And that level of consistency is so important, especially at the highest level. We know Pedro Porro's quality, he's quick, he's got a really good end product as well. But like I said earlier, with other players, you know, he's got to hit the ground running now, because that position is his own. He's got to make it his own. And as you say, it's a really important signing for Spurs, as I said, because maybe in the past where negotiations have been difficult, Spurs have been known to walk away from these things, but they really needed to solve this problem area. As you said, not really solved it since the strip year. And the fact they've done that now, the side just looks a little bit more complete now, especially with Danjuma up front providing more competition too. I think it's a really, really important signing for them, and we should see an instant impact.
Yeah, so those are our featured games to look out for this weekend, with the full Premier League fixture list looking like this. It's Chelsea v Fulham on Friday night before leaders Arsenal travel to Everton in the early game on Saturday. There are 5 3 p.m. on Saturday: Brighton, Bournemouth, Manchester United host Palace, Brentford play Southampton, Liverpool head to Wolves, and Villa face Leicester. Newcastle v West Ham is at 5:30. And on Sunday, Nottingham Forest take on Leeds at 2 o'clock ahead of Spurs versus Manchester City at 4:30. Rich, Man U are without Christian Eriksen until April at the earliest. They have replaced him, but that's a huge miss.
It is. He's really key to the way United like to play and try and build from the back. And he's formed a really good relationship with Casemiro in the midfield. And we know Ten Hag doesn't like to make too many changes. You know, we've seen a really consistent lineup now. I think most people could probably name United's starting lineup now, which I think is a good thing in terms of the inconsistencies that we've seen in previous seasons at Old Trafford. So, of course, he'll be a big miss. But one thing that Eric Ten Hag has done really well this season is he's kind of got his style of playing structure in place. Karl Anka reported in it this morning, called it automatisms, where they kind of go through repeated, almost choreographed routines. So every player knows what's expected of them. And you'd expect, McTominay, offer to come in and have a decent impact. Of course, you know, what they may lack in the passing range and stuff, they'll bring of energy, guile. And we've seen, especially with Fred, his improved performances this season. And obviously, Marcel Sabitzer are coming in. Exciting prospect. We know of his quality, great shooting ability, great passing as well. So he'll need to get up to speed. But it'll be a big miss, of course. But, United have the players to come in now. And with the structure in place, you'd expect United to still maintain the quality that they've shown already.
And George, Brighton take on Bournemouth this weekend. Will they be the most relieved side that the window's now closed? I know you touched on that earlier.
Yeah, I guess so. Brighton... I think, unlike other clubs, the relief from Brighton is different because Brighton have a price for a player, and if the clubs pay that price, they'll sell that player. You know, if Caicedo's price had been met, they'd have sold him, but it wasn't met, so they didn't, and they dug their feet in. He's back training now. So long as there hasn't been any issue reintegrating him into the squad, there shouldn't be an issue there. But Brighton, at some point, need to try and now, and they've done so well to bridge the gap between the bottom, the relegation area of the Premier League up towards those European places. If they're going to want to hang on to the likes of Caicedo, of McAllister, of Mitoma, they're going to have to convince them that they can achieve their ambitions within football at Brighton. And when one of them is a World Cup winner, that's going to be quite hard to do. So, I guess they're relieved now, but the way they operate means that they know how much they're going to accept for players. And if that isn't met, then the player isn't going to leave.
And Steve, this is the game I'm actually most looking forward to this weekend. Nottingham Forest against Leeds. That's a real pivotal game down at the bottom.
Yeah, very much. I mean, Forest are now fifth favourites down at 5-2 to be relegated. So they have, from the start of the season, they've managed to get some points on the board. And Leeds United, it seems like an eternity ago where Somerville was scoring at Anfield. There's going to be a little bit of needle in this game. I think more historically than ever, because of the Brian Clough Forest and Leeds and stuff like that. It's... be good throwback, and there's like Bavic Bamford. Was he a Forest fan when he was a kid? He's slowly getting back to form, which is great to see from a Leeds United point of view. I think Robin Koch being suspended, him and Verber were starting to build a good partnership at the back. Chris Wood will get a bit of stick, I think. I don't think Leeds fans like the way they left Leeds United as well. So there's a lot of different stories going around, and it's of course 3 points. We'll see that the price of the teams be relegated just on the drift. I think it's one of the most interesting games on the Premier League coupon this weekend.
Yeah, I think you're right, Steve. I think I'm really looking forward to watching this one on Sunday at 2 o'clock on the TV. It's a really intriguing fixture. It's your moment to shine now as well, Steve, because we're over to you for the 6 scores challenge.
the six scores challenge. We're still waiting for it to be the £1 million to win. I'm going to start with you, Dan, because it's Villa v Leicester, and you know I love going to you for Villa games.
Yeah. Villa to win 2-1 on their first Saturday 3 p.m. kickoff this season at home. Scandalous, but yeah, Villa will win that 2-1.
Oh, you haven't mentioned that before.
That is big news.
Yeah, okay. Man United versus Crystal Palace?
I'm going to go 2-1 again. 2-1 to Manchester United.
Okie dokie. George, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Wolves versus Liverpool. 1981, the last time Wolves beat Liverpool at home. Bruce Grobbelaar made his debut that day. 1-1. Okay. Newcastle, West Ham.
1-0.
2.
Newcastle. Home win.
Okay. Another clean sheet for Pope. Forest versus Leeds, Rich.
Yeah, I think Forest at home will be a really good game. I'm going to go for 2-2.
Okay. And finally, Spurs versus Manchester City, the big one.
Yeah, I'm going to throw a curveball in here. I think Spurs will win 2-1. City haven't travelled well. Spurs haven't won 0-4. Not that it matters. I think they'll still score. We'll see Haaland, of course. But yeah, I don't know. I've just got a sneaky feeling that Spurs will do a job somehow. So yeah, 2-1 Spurs.
Bold shirt. Okay, Rich, that's it for the six scores challenge, the free-to-play game.
Yeah, right at the end, Rich making sure we've got no chance of winning that £1 million between us. That's it from us here at the Weekend Preview. Chappers is going to be back with you to review it all on Monday. A reminder that if you are not already a subscriber, then go and take advantage of the £1.99 per month for the first 12 months offer by going to theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks ever so much for listening and enjoy all the football.
The Athletic.